ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost-of-living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor General.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of arguably the most dramatic moment in Australia's political history, the dismissal of the Whitlam government. Never before and never since has the Governor-General, representing the monarch, sacked a Prime Minister. It came at a time of enormous political upheaval in Australia, as Labor urgently sought to reshape the nation after decades of Conservative rule. But also, Labor ran into a series of political and policy difficulties. The dismissal itself shocked the nation, and for 50 years, debate has raged about how it all happened. Did the palace know? What about the CIA? Well, I'm keen to get a better understanding of this extraordinary moment and the lessons learned as we mark this anniversary. First, we're going to hear from journalist Nikki Savva, who was there on the day. And then Troy Bramston, whose new book about Gough Whitlam reveals exactly what was going on. I'm David Spears on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Nikki Savva, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Before we get to the events of that day, just give us a sense of what a very young Nikki Savva was up to back then. How long had you been in the press gallery covering politics, and what was it like covering that dramatic period of the Whitlam government?
Well, I arrived in February 1974, and from the day that I arrived, I was just hooked on politics because it was such a feeling, for young people anyway, of great excitement, great change, progress. You know, it seemed as if the country had been asleep for quite a few years and then all of a sudden was reawakening. But it was, for many people, a shock awakening. So there was something big happening every single day, which some people applauded and some people found, you know, pretty unsettling. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense of excitement but also chaos.
This is the crash or crash through. Not everything was going smoothly for Whitlam.
Not in the slightest, really. It was a very chaotic period, I think, from beginning until end. And when I arrived, there had been suggestions that there would be a double dissolution election coming up fairly soon, because the opposition was then planning to block supply and force the government to an election. So, you know, there was a sense that the coalition never actually accepted the legitimacy of the Whitlam government. And, you know, everything pointed towards instability and chaos.
Give us a sense of the main characters. You know, we sort of have an impression of Gough Whitlam today as a towering figure who, yes, wanted to urgently do a lot of things, dominated the landscape politically. But as you say, there was a lot of chaos involved as well. What was he like at the time as a political figure?
Well, there was something, you know, quite majestic about him, if you like, which also made him a bit aloof, I guess. Mm. He was extremely intelligent, extremely well-read, and everybody had to know that.
Right.
He didn't try to hide it. Yeah. It was impossible for him to hide it. So, you know, he was seen as probably a bit arrogant and removed. But within that, I mean, he was a Labour man to the core, and a lot of the things that he was doing went to Labour values and, you know, making life better for working class people and for the children of working class people, free universities, you know, supporting mothers' pensions, universal health care. You know, these were big things.
These are dramatic changes. These are dramatic changes.
Huge, which endure today,
exactly,
most of them.
Exactly, and it is notable that Anthony Albanese, in the few years that he's been in power, has been marking so many of these 50th anniversaries of things Gough Whitlam did. It's quite a reminder. Malcolm Fraser, so he becomes opposition leader. A lot of people, I think, would think of Malcolm Fraser in his post-parliamentary life, you know, doing a lot for refugee rights and so on. But at the time, as the Liberal leader in this dramatic political era, what was he like?
Well, he was seen as an aloof kind of figure too. I mean, they were both very tall, very big men, and they did literally tower over everyone.
Giants amongst the ordinary folk in
Parliament. The rest of us pygmies.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, quite a shy character, I think, in a lot of ways. Nowhere near as extroverted or as, you know, witty or as cutting as Whitlam could be. There was a kind of a reserve about him.
Traditionalist, was he?
Yes, very much, but also a very cool and contained character. You know, you wouldn't, he wasn't a cuddly kind of figure.
But clearly determined to keep the pressure on from day one with this, you know, threat about government maybe not filling out its full term.
Well, yes, and he was encouraged along that road by both the National Party and by the leader of the opposition in the Senate, Reg Withers, otherwise known as the toe cutter, for very good reason, because you either did what Withers said or, you know, you were likely to lose at least a few digits. So he was, Withers, in many respects, was the one who held the blowtorch to Malcolm as well. That's what people say now who look back on it.
And then the third main player in this whole saga, the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr. Was it clear that he was approaching that job in a different way to his predecessors before we get to the day of the dismissal?
Not all that obviously, but he was a very different kind of person from, say, Paul Hasluck, whom he succeeded. I mean, Hasluck was an experienced politician and, you know, knew about politics and, you know, also a very arrogant person. But Kerr was seen as a very vain person, very conscious of his status and his position. And his wife, his second wife, Nancy, even more so. So I think, you know, there was a feeling, well, Gough always said that Kerr would do the right thing.
And must do the right thing.
Expected him to do the right thing and made it clear that he expected him to do the right thing. And Kerr resented that.
Did not sit well.
Did not sit well with him. He did not want to be seen to be Kerr's, Gough's man at Government House. And also, you know, as the year progressed, he was worried that Gough was going to sack him. So he
really was fearing that it was Gough who was going to sack him all along. And do you think that is why he acted in the way that he did ultimately?
That is one reason why he was not fully up front with Whitlam about what he was planning.
And I'll come back to that. The day itself, tell us about it. What were you doing? What do you remember of, you know, talk about the chaos of the era, but the chaos of that day?
Well, it was November 11, right? Remembrance Day. So nobody thought really that anything dramatic would happen that day. I mean, we knew that something would have to happen to resolve the crisis because money was starting to run out. Public servants were worried they weren't going to get paid.
Because, I mean, this is, I mean, a bit like the shutdown in the US. This is a deadlock over supply that had been running for, well, how long had it been running for at that point?
A couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, people in the defence forces were worried that they weren't going to get paid. So we knew that it had to be resolved. In fact, I'd had, I remember I had a very clear conversation with Paul Kelly at one stage, who said to me, how do you think Gough would go at an election if he was sacked by the Governor General? And I said, he'd get slaughtered.
Wow.
Which, so it was
because
something...
Because of the chaos, this deadlock over supply, some of the economic data was not good. There were a lot of problems starting to build up.
Well, what led to the blocking of supply were things like the loans affair.
Yeah.
The Jim Cairns, Junie Morosi affair. So, you know, there was all sorts of other
scandals
which permeated and enveloped the government. And it didn't seem as if anything was getting done. Obviously, big things were getting done, but they were all overtaken by these scandals. So,
and you mentioned, I mean, if Paul Kelly's asking you that question, how would things go if he's dismissed? Was dismissal being talked about much leading up to the day?
Here and there, but right. It was, in a way, kind of theoretical, abstract, you know. I mean, as if the Governor-General was going to sack an elected Prime Minister. I mean, you talk about it in the way that you would talk about any number of possibilities, but you wouldn't really think that it would actually happen. So on November 11, we thought, you know, the story is going to be Remembrance Day. So I was, I arrived at work and then I went out at lunchtime because I had to collect some saucepans that I'd had on lay-by.
You had to collect some saucepans.
Priorities, you know.
Absolutely.
So
you are a very good cook, Nikki, I should point out. So that makes sense.
Well, you know, I never felt the same way about those saucepans again. I gave them to the Salvos after the event.
The famous saucepans.
Yeah, the famous. And they were hugely expensive. But anyway. We're getting sidetracked. So, so I had trouble finding a car park. So I had to park way up on Camp Hill, like near where this building is now.
Near where we are now. Yeah, the new Parliament.
And this guy was from the library was running past me and he said, Gough's been sacked by the Governor-General. And I said, what the hell? And started running back to the building. And then
ran down the hill.
Ran down the hill and got inside. And it was just absolute chaos.
Right.
Inside. I mean, people, headless chooks.
I can imagine what staff going in all directions, MPs obviously, journos, were members of the public starting to come into the building as well?
Not at that stage because there wasn't, you know, the communications that we have now.
Right.
No mobile phones, no 24-hour radio, no 24-hour TV. So... it took a while for word to get around, and especially as Gough, when he got sacked, got in his car and went to the lodge and had a steak for lunch and didn't tell his Senate colleagues what had happened. So, and nor did he tell the other members of his office. I mean, you'll hear their stories next week at Old Parliament House.
Yeah.
A number of them didn't know for a couple of hours after it had happened.
It's unthinkable today, isn't it? But it is extraordinary that the Labor senators sat in the Senate without knowing that the Prime Minister, the government, had been sacked.
Yeah. I did an interview.
And they passed the supply bills too, didn't they, at that point?
Well, because Gough had arranged to see Kerr that day to put to him his proposal for a half-Senate election.
He thought that'd fix it.
As if it would. It wasn't going to fix it. But anyway, that was his solution, right? So when he went off to Government House, I did an interview with Doug McClelland a couple of weeks ago, who was manager of government business in the Senate.
Right.
And he moved for the supply bills to be presented without knowing that Gough had been sacked. This was at 2 o'clock. And I said to him, why did you do that? Why did you move the bills? Because Withers knew what had happened.
Mm.
And Doug said that he assumed that Kerr had granted Whitlam's request for a half-Senate election. So
right.
That,
he thought, yeah.
So he thought the bills were going to be passed. And
turns out they were, but for a different reason.
They were, yeah.
Okay, so that happens in the Senate. Then the drama in the House when Gough does turn up there, and he had a plan to have a House vote pass a motion
of
supporting
no confidence.
Him. Well, of confidence in him as Prime Minister.
Yes, which was passed.
In the House.
In the House.
And then what happened?
Well, then they dispatched the Speaker, Gordon Scholes, to Government House to tell Kerr that Fraser did not have the confidence of the House. If you don't have the confidence of the lower house, how can you be Prime Minister? Mm. And basically they told Scholes to, you know, go back.
Well, they wouldn't let him in the gates at Government House. So, I mean, there's two things that John Kerr did that day. One is obviously the dismissal, which was a surprise to Whitlam, and then refusing to let the Speaker in to let him know what the House had just voted later on in the day. What do you make of that, looking back on what John Kerr did?
Well, you know, when Gough was on the front steps, he said, maintain your rage. Well, I have, because it was an outrage that a Governor-General sacked a duly elected Prime Minister. And what made it so much worse was that he deceived him. He did not forewarn him that this was a possibility, that it was something that he was considering, even though he had sought advice secretly, separately from the Prime Minister about whether he could sack him. And again, I did an interview with Paul Keating some time ago, and he was with Gough at Government House only a few days before the dismissal, and they were like old mates, apparently backslapping and laughing and carrying on. And looking back on it, Keating says now that Kerr was deliberately deceiving Whitlam and lulling him into a false sense of security. And when they got in the car to leave Government House that day after the Executive Council meeting, Keating said to Gough, well, what do you think? And Gough said something like, he'll be fine. He'll do the right thing.
He had no idea. What about the role of Malcolm Fraser? You wouldn't have known on the day, but we now know that he was also sitting in the building at Yarralumla, in a hidden away in another room. Would you call this collusion? What was going on there?
Well, Fraser had, usually when Fraser went to Government House, people were notified, told in advance, and Fraser had to seek an appointment, right? And they would put it out in viceregal notices. But they didn't tell anyone this time that Fraser was coming on that day. And Fraser arrived there early, before Gough. So he had to be taken to a separate room, and he sat there and waited. And then Gough arrived and was taken in to see Kerr, and it was all over in a matter of minutes. Gough was sacked.
But they had spoken before that day as well, Kerr and Fraser.
They'd had a number of meetings, yes.
And dismissal had come up, as far as we know.
Well, there are various accounts of what happened. So, you know, one of the most frustrating things about all of this is that I don't think we've got the full story yet of what happened. And part of the reason, I guess, is because most of them have fallen off their perches, you know. Malcolm has died, Gough has died, Kerr has died. So the central characters, you know, no longer with us, and they can't be questioned. They can't come on insiders and be interrogated by David Spears.
Exactly. But do you think any of this could happen again in Australia?
The mechanisms are still there. The powers still exist. The Governor-General still has reserve powers. The Senate can still block supply. But my big thing is that it needs characters like the ones who were there. It needs Kerr. It needs Whitlam, and it needs a Fraser, and it also needs a Withers. Now, David, do you reckon there are any people like that around these days in Federal Parliament and the Government House?
Look, let me just say, I wish I had been there at the time in 1975. It does sound like an extraordinary time to be a political journalist.
It was extraordinary, and they are extraordinary characters. You know, I mean, the fact, I think it, you know, I feel an enormous privilege that I was there on that day and beforehand and actually got to witness such a piece of history because, well, I hope it's never repeated. I don't think it will ever be repeated. But to see all those characters come together like that and then to have this explosion, really, was, you know, journalist's dream. A nightmare for the country, but
great for journalism. I'm very glad you were there on that day, Nikki Saverin. I'm very glad you're able to tell us all about it today. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we now know far more than we did 50 years ago about the events leading up to and on the day itself of November 11, 1975, thanks to the work of historians and authors, including Troy Bramston, who's just written a new book, Gough Whitlam, The Vista of the New. Troy Bramston, welcome.
Thanks very much, David.
So, look, you have devoted years, really, to uncovering what happened and why in 1975. Why has this gripped you so intensely, and what is it about those events that really did help shape our nation in many ways?
Yeah, look, I've been on some kind of a dismissal odyssey for more than 30 years. You know, I remember very vividly as a Year 10 student when John Kerr died. That was 1991. And I was fascinated by this character. It was a front page news, and it set me on this kind of journey of discovery. I've interviewed all the key players, except John Kerr, because he had died. But, you know, I've been into the archives. I've spoken to people at the palace, people at Government House, Whitlam, Fraser, all the sort of key people to try to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, 50 years later, we are still learning things for the first time and understanding it better than I think we ever have before.
And you've been writing about this, and there's constantly new revelations. What do we now know, starting with John Kerr, about what the Governor General was thinking, who he was talking to, how long had he planned, do you think, this move to dismiss the Whitlam government?
Well, I think John Kerr was probably the worst person for Gough Whitlam to appoint ahead of a constitutional crisis. He was appointed in mid-1974. He took over the role of Governor General, but he had this fascination with the reserve powers. As a university student, he'd been an acolyte of H.V. Evatt, who had written a book about the reserve powers. So he had this fascination with it. And even before he's formally sworn into the role, he's thinking, I might have an opportunity to use these powers if there is some kind of constitutional or political crisis. So that's what he's thinking about. And of course, he consults Anthony Mason, the former High Court Justice, but a justice at the time, looking at the reserve powers and looking at potential scenarios where he might have to use them. And one of the things I've been able to uncover for this book, David, is these kind of deathbed notes. You know, in the last years of his life, John Kerr continued to revisit the dismissal again and again and again. He writes that it was his death destiny. It was his duty to do this. He blamed Whitlam and Fraser for putting him in the middle in this situation and making him their scapegoat. So he's wanting to play a big role in national events, and he sees an opportunity and he takes it, but he spends the rest of his life second-guessing it and wondering whether or not it was really worth the public opposition to him that he dealt with for the rest of his remaining days.
Yeah, and he certainly did, second-guessing it perhaps for the rest of his life, but any sign he ever regretted it?
No, there's no sign that he regretted it. He felt this was, as I say, his duty and his destiny. But, you know, on the day of the dismissal, this dramatic, convulsive day in our national politics, he was a bit shocked by the public reaction. You know, there were protests, marches, there was violence in all the cities. Of course, we know Gough Whitlam's famous speech on the steps of the parliament, you know, very indignant. And David Smith, his official secretary, told me that Kerr did briefly consider resigning. He thought that he had damaged the office of Governor-General and it might need time to restore itself. And then, of course, he remained in the role for the next few years, but he couldn't travel anywhere for fear of hostile demonstration. So it did have a really big personal effect on him. But no, he never changed his mind. He thought it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, but it changed his life, clearly, from then on. When did he finally decide, do you think, to do it?
Look, he made the final decision a few days before, sort of probably the end of the week before, and he talked to his wife, he talked to Anthony Mason. I gather he would have talked to some of his staff, maybe David Smith, and he's writing these notes. The events are moving towards some kind of a conclusion. And this is a really important point, David, because he didn't confide in his Prime Minister. He didn't say to Whitlam, listen, I think you're on the wrong track here. You need to find an alternative pathway. I'm not sure that a half Senate election, which was Whitlam's resolution to the crisis, was the right way to go.
Did he have an obligation to do that, to confide in his Prime Minister or the Prime Minister what he was thinking?
Yeah, there is a protocol or a convention that if you're going to use reserve powers, then there is a kind of a natural justice element to it, that you should talk to the person about them. And, you know, the palace is writing to Kerr saying, only use these powers as a last resort when there's no other alternative. They're saying to him that sometimes it's better not to use the powers, but actually to refer to them. So he had an opportunity to confide in Whitlam and say, look, we need to find another pathway here short of a surprise dismissal. And Whitlam's great criticism of Kerr was that it was a dismissal by ambush. That is, that he had no warning that this was coming.
And even Malcolm Fraser, as you have revealed, Troy Bramston, did feel later on that, yes, Kerr should have given Whitlam some notice.
Yeah, this is, I think, an extraordinary discovery I found in Malcolm Fraser's papers. He had written a draft obituary for Gough Whitlam years before he died, and wrote that he thinks that he'd come to the view that Kerr should have discussed the crisis more freely with Whitlam and not deceived him. And he should have given him a formal warning that a half-Senate election wasn't really going to help get the budget through the Senate. It wasn't going to resolve the supply crisis, and he needed to talk to him. So even Malcolm Fraser, this is the man who benefited most from the dismissal. He became Prime Minister. He thought that Kerr had mismanaged his role during the crisis.
Do you think Fraser had any regrets over his own actions?
This is a really interesting question. You know, I did lots of interviews and had lots of conversations with Malcolm Fraser. He didn't really like talking about it. He told me once the dismissal was an exhausted subject. I think we've demonstrated that it's not exhausted. He changed his views on a lot of things and moderated his views on a lot of things, but he never changed his view about the dismissal. He thought it was right to push the political system to the brink, to bring the Whitlam government to an end. And this is the real Malcolm Fraser when we think about 1975. He's ruthless. He's cold-blooded. He's determined. He is pushing that political system to the brink. He's smashing precedents. He's shattering conventions. He's really wanting to destroy the government, and he never regretted that for one moment.
You touched on the palace earlier. There has been confusion and debate and controversy around what the palace did or didn't know. What's your view? The Queen, the then Prince Charles, how aware were they of what Kerr was up to?
I think it's pretty clear in the viceregal correspondence that a lot of this is surprising to people. It's shocking that the palace is sort of so involved, but this is how the palace operates. They want to be kept informed, but they're not directing events. And there's a really important letter that is sent to John Kerr from Martin Charteris, the Queen's private secretary, a week before the dismissal. And he says to him, this is a political crisis, not a constitutional crisis. He says, you're thinking about these powers and maybe using them, but they should only be used as a last resort when there's no other alternative. He uses this phrase that maybe you could use, not use the powers, but refer to the powers. That's their real value. And so I don't think there's any evidence in the letters that the palace or the Queen encouraged the dismissal or knew about it in advance or gave it any kind of a green light. And that's pretty much the view of all the leading constitutional scholars in Australia, like George Williams and Anne Toomey, and even the ministers who are still with us from the Whitlam government, Paul Keating and Doug McClellan. They don't think the Queen would have had any involvement in this. It's not how she operated, liquidating prime ministers in her realms. It's not what she would do. And one of the things I've been able to do with this book is get a whole lot of John Kerr's papers reopened or opened for the first time, had redactions removed and things like that. So we can see what was going through his mind. He's a guy who decided that the Whitlam government had to be terminated, but he said he would operate by stealth. He would not tell the prime minister what he's really thinking. And because he had this obsession, David, that he himself was going to be dismissed, he thought that if he told Whitlam what he was thinking, and dismissal might be a resolution to the crisis, that he himself would be dismissed. And that was why he decided to deceive his prime minister 50 years ago.
What about the conspiracy theory around the CIA in all of this? We know that Whitlam had put the US offside by openly criticising their role in their actions in the Vietnam War early on in his time as PM. He talked about the future of Pine Gap and raised some concerns on the US side about that. There was the raid of ASIO that upset the CIA. What do you think about any involvement in the CIA when it comes to the dismissal of Gough Whitlam?
Look, it kind of excites the imagination, you know, that there's a foreign source that has intervened in our politics and dismissed our prime minister. I don't think there's any evidence for that. I've been through all the US archives at the presidential libraries. I interviewed Henry Kissinger, who was Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. The papers show that the relationship with the United States was at a low point. As you point out, there were some pretty sharp disagreements, but the US felt they could actually rely on Whitlam against more extreme left elements, as they called them, within his government. So they saw Whitlam as an alliance supporter, an alliance defender. They thought he would renew the licenses and the leases over the US bases in Australia. And there's just no documentary evidence that the US sought to interfere in this way. I had an opportunity years ago to interview Jimmy Carter, who came into office and really was launching a number of inquiries and changing US policy where it had intervened in a number of other countries in their politics. And he said to me that he couldn't find any evidence for a US involvement in Australian politics. So it excites the imagination, but I think we need to accept 50 years on that this is a homegrown tragedy, a homegrown disaster for our political system, and we did it to ourselves.
When you look back with all the research you've done, all the people you've spoken to, and you look back on the day itself, what, I guess, unknowns are there still for you about what went down at Parliament House, but also at Yarralumla on the 11th?
Look, I think I've really exhausted all the archives. I've exhausted all the interviews. It is a day of drama. It's a convulsive day for our politics. It was shocking. But, you know, even as early as September 1975, David, Malcolm Fraser was saying if the government can't get its budget through the Senate and won't recommend a general election, then the Governor-General should intervene and dismiss the Prime Minister. So this was, in many ways, always the opposition strategy, but a lot of people in the media, a lot of people in the public seemed to miss that. They didn't really take that very seriously. And that's exactly what happened. But, you know, I think it was a train wreck for our political system, for our parliamentary democracy. I don't think there's any heroes here. You know, Gough Whitlam was aloof and arrogant, ignored warning signs about Kerr, didn't undertake any contingency planning. He lost his job. Malcolm Fraser was ruthless and cold-blooded. He torched these conventions. He pushed the system to the brink. And then his ministers like Andrew Peacock and John Howard told me that he was cautious and timid in government as Prime Minister because he was worried about the forces that he had unleashed, the opposition he had unleashed in the Australian community. And then, of course, there's John Kerr, who became a kind of a sad, lonely figure, always second-guessing his actions and spent many years in exile abroad. So there are no winners in this crisis, but I think it was a breakdown in our parliamentary democracy. And all the institutions now, I think, are pretty determined to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, and I think you've done it there, how history remembers and should remember those three main players in all of this, Whitlam, Fraser and Kerr. You don't think any of them particularly come out of this particularly well, and were clearly, you know, reshaped in terms of the course of the rest of their lives by that moment 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And look, Gough Whitlam's the Prime Minister. He said to me that he wanted to be remembered not as a martyr, but as an achiever. I mean, this was obviously not a good outcome for him. And, you know, he is not without blame in this crisis. I mean, as I think I've been able to demonstrate, there's memos after memos. There's politicians, there's staff who are coming to him saying there's a dismissal risk here. But he was determined to follow his own star. He thought he knew John Kerr. He thought he was the only person who could handle the crisis. And he misjudged the situation. I don't think he ever really had a viable solution to getting his budget through the Senate. And he wanted a half Senate election, but I don't think that would have changed the numbers in the Senate. So he was the ultimate loser, I think, in 1975. And he's not without blame, and nor are the other two key protagonists.
I mean, it's hard to see that this sort of event ever happens again, but how did this, Troy Bramston, reshape the way politics is done and the way that intersection between the government and the Governor-General operates in Australia?
I think there is now a recognition, you know, all of the Governors-General since John Kerr have said in a roundabout kind of way that they would never do what he did. That is, act secretly, act deceptively, not confide in his Prime Minister. You know, the role of the Governor-General is not to be a constitutional umpire between two warring political parties. It's to be a constitutional guardian, has to protect the system and avoid confrontation. And that's a lesson also from the monarchy in Britain. And I think there's a recognition there. There's a recognition that, you know, Sir Garfield Barwick had given some legal advice to John Kerr. Anthony Mason had secretly consulted with him. There's a recognition, I think, the court wouldn't be involved in this again. And of course, we haven't seen a coalition or a Labor senators seek to block a budget again or delay it through the Senate. So I think there's a recognition now that we can't let this happen to ourselves again. And the other thing is, of course, these personalities are so vivid, so ambitious, so heavily character drawn that we're unlikely to see that combination again between a strong-willed Prime Minister, a strong-willed opposition leader and a Governor-General who is sort of animated and excited about using the reserve powers, but fearful as well that he will be dismissed and decides to deceive his Prime Minister.
Well, Troy Bramston, congratulations on the book, Gough Whitlam, The Vista of the New, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, David.
And thanks for joining us. If you have any thoughts on this conversation or the anniversary of the dismissal itself, drop us a line, insiders@abc.net.au. Hope to see you Sunday morning for Insiders, 9 a.m. on ABC TV.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.